Dark Side of the Toon has returned, and now at an even darker time spot. Tune in on Thursdays at 9 p.m. to get your dose of alternative music, including but not limited to metal, grunge, goth, and more. Hope to see you there.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Hello and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate student research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I am your host of this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to find out all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are currently working on. And today, I'd like to introduce you to Sarvanas Hirani Mogadam, who is doing her PhD in kinesiology under the supervision of Drs. Aaron Cressman and Dr. Jerome Manson. Welcome to Grad Chat, Sarv.
Hi, Katie Marie. Nice to see you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And I'm really looking forward to learning about your research. But at first, I was just curious, why did you choose Queen's in the first place?
I'm really excited to be here, and I chose Queen's mostly because of Jerome's research. Mm. I've always been really fascinated with how people move in general. Like, we can make all these really, you know, routine movements to pick up our water bottles or pick up our coffee cups. And even though this seems very simple, when things go wrong in the background, like our, you know, if somebody has a stroke, for example, or with Parkinson's disease, these really simple movements become really difficult. Mm. And Jerome's research really digs into this from different aspects. So I wanted to come to Queen's to get to work with him. And I'm also co-supervised with Dr. Aaron Cressman, who does similar research at University of Ottawa.
Oh, very cool. So you are a PhD student at both Queen's and the University of Ottawa.
Yes. Yeah, they've been incredible. They're very supportive of me and my projects, and the whole journey has been great.
Oh, good. So I'm glad to hear that. So you mentioned a lot about movement there, but can you tell us specifically about what your PhD topic is all about?
Yeah. So in regards to that, I look at how people learn movement patterns, and just I like to kind of make it relatable a little bit at the beginning before I get into the specifics. So
thank you, because I am not an expert in this field whatsoever.
So. Yeah. So if you can think about, like, humans who go to space, for example, or go underwater really deep, and we're still able to kind of use tools and be able to be accurate in different environments. So in space, for example, there's different gravity than what we're used to on Earth. And underwater, there's different visual information that we have to deal with in order to use different tools. And the human body and the brain is able to control those types of movements and help us, you know, get the task that we want to get done. I don't do research in space or underwater, but I use robotics and virtual reality to be able to kind of simulate different novel visual information for people and watch how they move. Essentially, looking at their reaching movements and look at kinematics such as position of your hand, velocity, acceleration, stuff like that. So I have an example that everyone can relate to. So if you ever, like, you're using your own computer and you're used to kind of you moving the mouse around and you know how fast the mouse moves and where things are on your screen, you're pretty comfortable with that. But if you switch to your friend's computer and maybe they have different mouse settings or something.
Oh, that is awful, right? And the keyboard's slightly different. Everything's just a little off.
Yeah, everything's a little off, but you get used to it really quickly, right? Like, so my research has to do a lot with that, of how do we adapt in novel environments like that? Like, how is the brain able to make adjustments or help us make those adjustments to our fine movements to be able to be accurate in using another person's computer? Yeah, so
Oh, that sounds really cool. So mm-hmm. when you test this and look at how people adapt, are you looking at a certain population of people? Are you working with a wide population? What are your participants look like, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Right. So a lot of research in our area, obviously there's a clinical side, but mm-hmm. I'm more on the healthy young population.
Okay.
Because the idea is to kind of understand the healthy nervous system and the healthy brain before we can actually apply this to the clinical population. Mm-hmm. So all of my participants for my PhD and for my master's, they've been healthy young adults, and they come in and they kind of essentially help us learn about or help us add to the literature of how does the healthy brain move in novel environments. And then this can be a foundation for rehabilitation programs and even coaching and instructional programs or even curriculum for medical training and dentistry training and stuff like that. Because if you think about, for example, certain surgeries that are done using new technologies and robotics, mm-hmm. and also dentists every day, they use mirrors, for example, to kind of get into people's mouths and mm-hmm. Be in different angles, and they have to like go through certain training. So my research sort of can be applied to any of these areas because it's a fundamental research, like looking at the healthy mm-hmm. nervous system and how people move in novel environments. So it can have different applications.
Oh, very cool. So it sounds like there's a wide variety of ways some of your findings can be used by other researchers or other clinicians or other practitioners in the future. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you do virtual reality environments. So when a participant comes to work with you, what does that look like?
Mm-hmm. So that's a really good question, because I found, you know, with data collection, if participants hadn't been in the area mm-hmm. or hadn't been in the room, they would be a little, you know, curious and almost nervous to be, you know, you're working with something new. You're already like in a new environment. But I mean, most of my participants were graduate students or undergraduate students who were in the university already. So essentially when participants come in, they go through the consent form. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of forms that they have to fill out, just like any other human.
Yes, any study, of course, study. Yes.
And then I get them introduced to the KinArm. So the KinArm is the main robot that I use, or equipment that I use for my data collection. It's essentially you are seated on a chair, and then the setup is there's a TV that's facing down.
Okay.
And then there's a mirror underneath this TV that essentially reflects what's on the TV on the mirror or the reflective surface. Mm-hmm. And that's where the visual information is given to participants.
Okay.
And then the participants are in the chair. Their arms are in troughs. It's kind of like a robot exoskeleton.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, that is holding onto their hand, their lower arm, and their upper arm. And then I push them forward so their forehead kind of rests on the TV mm-hmm. and their eyes are looking at the reflective surface. And what's interesting about this setup is that you can think of changing people's visual informations maybe by giving them prism goggles, right? Mm-hmm. So giving people prism goggles already sort of tells them, oh, something may change in my environment, in my visual environment. And this is what's the difference between having prism goggles or doing studies with prism goggles versus the KinArm, is because when you have someone in the KinArm, so now their hands are in troughs, they're in that environment, they're not able to see their hands, mm-hmm. and they actually they don't know what they're going to see on the screen. Mm-hmm. Or mm-hmm. I have told them a little bit about, you know, you're going to make reaching movements, you're going to go to the target, there's going to be targets on the screen that you have to reach to. But otherwise, the manipulation that we're going to give to them can stay below conscious awareness. That becomes really important for my study, because, you know, earlier studies that were looking at this, how does the brain go through and process this novel environment or novel mm-hmm. visual motor environment is what we call it.
Okay.
The fancy word is visual motor, but it's just visual and movement mm-hmm. together. So visual motor was using prism goggles. But that, again, like this component of it being a conscious thing that happened, I'm putting prism goggles on, I see my visual field shift. Mm-hmm. It's something that's important for my study that, you know, participant, this thing doesn't become conscious for participants unless if they, you know, figure something out during the study.
Yeah. Yeah. And hopefully, I think by this point, by the time the show airs, you've collected all of your data with participants, so there's no spoilers for future participants if they, if anyone is coming to know that they don't know that you have altered the perception that they may be seeing a little bit to influence your data.
Exactly. I'm actually done data collection.
Congratulations.
Yes. So, I'm actually currently done. Yeah. I'm almost done my first paper too at this point.
Oh, very nice.
Almost.
Okay. That is exciting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that takes a lot of work. And it sounds like from the way you have so many different inputs, right, with the kin arm, it sounds like you've got, if I'm understanding this correctly, where people's arms are in the trough of the robot kind of guiding them. You're collecting data from all of these different points, from the kin arm, from eye movements that you're tracking, and from what the participant is seeing and what they're doing, what they're reaching. How do you work with all of these, I assume, thousands and thousands of data points? How do you work with all of this mm-hmm. data?
Honestly, I wish I had the time and the capacity to collect all of that data. I actually mm-hmm. don't have eye movement data. That would be really interesting.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And there have been studies that have used eye movement data. I only look at the index finger.
Okay.
So I'm very interested in like seeing like where the index finger is relative to the visual information that are on the screen. So if I want to tell you a little bit more like specifics about my study is that, so now the participant is in the kin arm, they're mm-hmm. all set up, there's a calibration process, and the kin arm collects data at 1,000 hertz. So I get 1,000 samples per second.
Wow. Well, you said I don't even collect that much data. That sure sounds like a lot of data to work with to me.
Yeah, and for my PhD, I have tested upwards of 200 people.
Wow.
So over 4 experiments. Oh. So it is.
So you have a lot of data. You're being humble. You have a ton of data to work with.
So yeah, I have participants. Essentially, it's a very simple movement. It's you move from a home position, mm-hmm. it's a white home position, and there's a target. And all you have to do is to get this pink cursor that's on the screen to the target. And you have mm-hmm. to make shooting movements. So you're in the home position, the target shows up, and you have to shoot and slice through the target to get this pink cursor to the target.
Right? Okay.
And at the beginning, it's really important to get a sense of where participants are in terms of this movement at baseline to mm-hmm. understand any biomechanical differences or biomechanical biases that they might have. So they go through this baseline process, and we kind of see that a lot of people are very good at this. So they get this pink cursor to the target, they're very accurate, and they finish this baseline phase. And then where the manipulation comes in is this training phase. So my main research question had to do with this idea of a mirror-verse feedback. There has been a lot of studies using a rotated visual feedback, which I'll describe in a second. Mm-hmm. But with my PhD project, I was really interested in if the brain can kind of take this mirror transformation. So essentially where the mirror-versal is that in your midline, there's a mirror-versal that is going to happen where when your hand goes to the right, mm-hmm. you see this pink cursor or the pink feedback go to the left.
Mm-hmm.
So understanding this difference, are we able to kind of learn this transformation, and is it similar to a rotated visual feedback? So a rotated visual feedback is very similar, but it's a consistent change. So we're able to kind of program. So I program just a 20 degree difference between where the hand is and where the cursor is for the rotated visual feedback. So this is just rotated. It's always going to be 20 degrees. And because it's small, it stays below conscious awareness. So
people don't realize, they just adjust automatically to the rotated version. They don't know that they're doing it necessarily, but they just account for it, and the brain goes forward and the hand goes where it should according to what the brain's taking in. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I used a lot of that literature in the kind of the rotated visual feedback. There's been a lot of work done on the rotated visual feedback stuff, and then try and apply it or try and learn a bit more about this mirror-versal. So we tried to keep this mirror-versal small also. The studies that had done studies with this mirror-versal feedback had used a large distortion. So they put this, so essentially you have to put the targets very strategically from the y-axis to then get a certain degree of distortion essentially from your hand movement. And previous studies had put these targets really far from the y-axis. So you get this like either 45 degree or a 90 degree difference between where your hand goes and where they see the feedback. So we thought, okay, why don't we put the targets closer to the y-axis and then see if we try and keep this distortion small. So your hand goes to the target, you see this cursor go 20 degrees away from your hand, or 10 degrees essentially from the y-axis. Because the target would be 10 degrees to the right of the y-axis. So you get this like 20 degree difference between your hand motion and the feedback. And whether, you know, participants, are they learning it in a similar manner? Can they learn it in a similar manner? And then whether, so then it's important for me to also explain conscious and unconscious processes that help us learn these two. So maybe I backtrack a little bit. So in the visual motor rotation literature, so essentially like you described it really beautifully, where you said, you know, when participants reach with that 20-degree rotated visual feedback, it stays below conscious awareness. Yes, like participants reach to it. And the way we test that is we take the visual feedback away. Mm-hmm. So there's a target and they reach to the target. But after this learning phase, they're still reaching deviated from the target, even though they're asked, you know, they're asked to reach to the target. They're still going, you know, sideways or offset.
That little 20, they're still going that 20% that they just learned.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, they're still going. So that tells us, you know, even if you're asked to go to the target, the motor system is still doing or still kind of preoccupied with the what it did before, where the feedback was 20 degrees.
Takes a little while to catch up and remember or how to readjust, I guess, or remember where you're going now without this kind of manipulation or intervention. Is that?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And this is called an after effect. So you do go through this visual motor rotated trials and you get this after effect. So after effects are implicit or unconscious in nature. And a lot of literature in motor learning have been thinking that everything in motor learning is implicit. But more recently, we know that not conscious processes also teach us about movement, right? Like, for example, conscious processes are more strategic. Those are the instructions that you receive when you're learning something new. Or even if you're not learning something new, you're using pre-existing movements that you know and you're just making adjustments to it.
An example be, and correct me if I'm wrong, but like when you're driving a car and you're used to applying a certain amount of pressure to the gas pedal in your car, and then you drive a friend's car and you go to apply the same, but then you're consciously being like, oh, I'm not going as fast as I think I would. So you increase. Would that be an example of conscious?
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. That's definitely a really good example of the conscious process. So then I try and kind of measure these things. So I measure conscious and unconscious processes when participants start adapting or learning in these novel environments, be it a rotated visual feedback or a mirror-verse feedback.
Okay. Yeah. So that sounds like, as you said before, you mentioned some different applications, but it sounds like you said, it's fundamental research. So it just helps us understand a lot of different things, and then how other people take it is up to them. So what are some areas that you think could really benefit from the findings from your work so far?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, this work is really like, it's really rooted in psychology as well. Like some of these conscious processes that we look at are called awareness. So awareness of changes in your reaches and also kind of planning your movement. So pre-planning a movement. So a lot of the work that we do has to do like with psychology as well. But in terms of application, like I think I've been watching a lot of volleyball recently. The Volleyball Nations League is going on right now. It's in the summer of 2025. And I just keep going back to one coach. This is Iran's coach, Roberto Piazza. He's been really good at, like, in volleyball, they get really short amounts of time when they take a timeout during a game, like during a really like intense game. And he's able to use instructions or words that really sticks with these players. So my work, you know, I use a lot of instructions to ask people to, you know, for example, use a strategy they learned, and then that kind of comes out in their movement. So strategy use or like instruction giving is probably like one of the applications of my work. How to give instructions or like how to, if someone's learning something new or if they're coming back to a sport, how do we keep them engaged? Or if somebody, you know, for example, if you have an injury, for example, or you go to the physio, people usually tend to go back to physios that give good instructions, right? Or, you know, you can relate to their instructions and stuff like that. So a lot of it has to do with instruction giving and how do we use instruction to drive some of this learning. I think that's one of the applications of rehab and coaching.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a ton of, I mean, and rehab is so broad, like so many people need help recovering or relearning or learning new ways to be after, you know, a change in their health. So not just rehab for athletes, which comes to my mind first, but rehab for all sorts of people, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that is exciting to see. And so what made you interested then in this research in the first place?
So it actually goes way back, and I maybe didn't know this when I first started grad studies, but now I'm finishing up my PhD and starting to reflect on the journey and thinking kind of what got me interested is, so my grandfather actually had Parkinson's disease. And this was now, I think he was diagnosed with it more than 20 years ago. And it was in Iran. And I remember he had diabetes for a very long time. And when his motor symptoms started showing up, like for example, one symptom is freezing of gait. When you're walking, like you kind of freeze, like when you're like in the middle of your walk,
like mid-step,
kind of thing. Okay. Yeah. And his doctors were really confused. They were like, wait, we've been treating your cardiovascular system for so long, like what's going on with the motor system? Like, and I just remember it being a time where his doctors weren't sure what was happening, and he started showing tremors as well. So he was like, his hands were shaking when he was trying to reach for stuff. And, you know, shortly after he passed away. So I've always been really interested in the motor system and how we move, to then be able to apply it to the clinical population. And it comes from a very personal background. And yeah, and I mean, my PhD hasn't been working with Parkinson's patients directly, but again, like a lot of this fundamental work can be applied to clinical populations. And yeah, my next step for my postdoc is going to be working with people with stroke, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
So even though, I mean, fundamental research is so important, right? Because it helps everyone, but then you're going to be, you personally will be transitioning from a more fundamental research to a more applied research area. Oh, that's very exciting. And we are recording in the summer, but when, what, where will you be headed for your postdoc?
I'm actually going to be going to UBCO in Kelowna.
Oh, yeah. Very nice. Okay, so the University of British Columbia, Okanagan?
Yes.
Oh, very nice. Okay.
Yeah. And that's in probably starting in January.
But okay.
We will see about that.
Yes. Finish the PhD first, exactly. Get it off of your plate, and then you can look forward. Yeah. Oh, that's exciting. So you have been up to many, many things, it sounds like, throughout this project. Well, doing four studies with over 200 participants and working across two universities with two supervisors. You sound like you've been up to a lot in the research arena, but I've heard that you've also been involved with some research activities in whatever spare time you have left. So what have you been doing at Sheridan College?
So that's really interesting. So at Sheridan College, I'm an external board member on their research ethics board.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, so I get to see and review some of their applications that come in through their REB or research ethics board. And it's been really interesting. That, and I work with, you know, they have their whole team. Like, we do full board meetings and we get delegated reviews sometimes, like depending on what areas of research we're interested in. And I just, since my master's, I just find the ethics process really, really interesting. And a lot of my colleagues don't. So, yeah, I'm always the one, you know, reading the consent forms and like going through different parts of their applications just to make sure they're hitting all the different steps. And I find it really interesting. And yeah, and recently I was at a conference in Toronto at York University where somebody was talking about neuroethics. So kind of bridging the gap between kind of neuroscience, that's my background, and kind of the nervous system and like the brain data versus ethics. Like, how is brain data used in different parts of the world, like in courtrooms and stuff like that? And what are the boundaries of that? Which is really interesting. I never thought like I would be the person who say, you know, I really like the ethics boards and like like thinking about these things, like what needs to be included in consent forms when you're testing human beings and like, you know,
no, that's
like
really
that.
Important work. So how did you get involved with that at Sheridan College?
Yeah, I was going to say that right now, like my friend Laura, shout out to Laura, actually. She's incredible. She graduated from her PhD from U Ottawa in the same area as me, like looking at motor learning, I think 2 years ago now. And she's been working at Sheridan College as their head of research. So, and she's also part of the REB. Yeah, so she got me, I was talking with her about her new job and how things are going. And she was like, hey, like, we're looking for external board members. Like, if you're interested, you can sit on the board and stuff like that. And I thought about it. I was like, that's actually pretty cool. And these meetings are completed online. So even though I'm in Kingston, I can still join their meetings online, because Sheridan has three campuses, but this one, I think, so they have an Oakville campus, there's one in Hamilton, I think, so yeah, this is them, their main campus.
Oh, very nice. So that's really cool to see you taking your work and your interest in ethics specifically in other totally different contexts and helping out other researchers at Sheridan College and in other places to continue this discussion about what is ethical in research and how should we work with people when we want to work with them. Oh, that is fascinating stuff. And well, thank you for doing all that, because the research community needs people to help each other, because otherwise who would do that work, right? So it's great to have, I think, up and coming emerging scholars contributing to these discussions and kind of steering where discussions of ethics go in the future. Because as you said, not everyone is interested in ethics or maybe even scared of ethics is maybe the right way to say it. I know some people are afraid to apply because they just don't know. But
opening those conversations is really important. Mm-hmm. And outside of this, I also hear that you are enjoying many different sports and activities. So what are you currently up to activity-wise?
You know, being a kin student, yeah. And all like the stereotype. Recently I've just been enjoying volleyball a
very
lot.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. And still, like, I'm still doing triathlon training, like swim, bike, run. That's like where I just decompress and like I just find that I sleep a lot better with sports. So yeah. Like that's my main reason. I'm like, okay, if I'm active during the day, I'm able to sleep, and that just helps me the next day as well. So yeah, swimming, biking, running.
Are you preparing for any races currently?
Currently, no. I have a bunch of volleyball tournaments.
Oh, very nice.
Up.
Okay.
Yeah, but a race. I think I'm gonna do the Niagara half marathon or something.
Oh, wow.
Probably that's
okay.
In October. But yeah, I did a half Ironman last year. Yeah. Yeah, and that was really, really fun.
That sounds fun is one word for it, but challenging perhaps. Yeah.
Yeah, that was really cool. But I just found, you know, with trying to push to finish the PhD, I just did not have enough time to put into triathlon or the Ironman training. Mm-hmm. But last week I did a trail race. I did 10K trail race in Milton. It was really cool. It was like the terrain was everything that you could imagine. There were rocks, there were smaller rocks and big rocks, and you would go uphill, and then like the first 5K was uphill, and then you would come back same way. Yeah. It was really, really good. Like it was a hot day too, but it was over because it was only a 10K. Like it was quick.
Only a 10K.
Yeah. Your perspective changes.
I guess so. Yes, if you've done the half Ironman and things like that. But how do you find? You mentioned that it helps you sleep, but how do you find balancing the activities that you enjoy, like volleyball, running, swimming, and all of this research and other volunteer work that you're doing? How are you able to balance all of these things at once?
So I find that I'm able to be my best self and my best research self if I am active during the day, you know? Like, I'm able to show up for those long writing hours. Like if I either have something during lunch, like I can look forward to, like either a swim, go for a swim during lunch, or I go for a run after work or something like that, just to, you know, just to do something else. And because I do a lot of, like, I understand kind of human anatomy and ergonomics. I actually taught a course at Queen's in ergonomics.
Oh, very cool.
So yeah, even like sitting at a desk, I'm constantly aware of, like, you know, my posture, and like maybe I've been sitting for too long and things start hurting, and I know that if I don't move, I'm gonna hurt, like it's just gonna hurt more the next day. So in order to sit longer, I need to like move as well. So it kind of goes hand in hand, I think, everything I do. And then with when I do volunteer work at Sheridan, that's really fulfilling. And also I feel like the part where I can apply what I've learned to an actual, like a research board, then I can contribute.
Yeah.
Kind of thinking about different systems that they have at their RAB, that I find that really fulfilling. So I think the whole, it's like a cycle for me. It's like, okay, I have to do like, yeah, this many hours of writing, or I have this to-do list to get done, but can I be in a better headspace for it? And can I do less staring at my screen and more like productive work if I actually get up and do something and then come back to it?
No, I think that's a really great lesson to remember, because sometimes when you're, especially when you're at the end and you're in this writing phase, you end up just sitting at your desk or sitting at a coffee shop or sitting in the library for hours on end. And like you said, sometimes you're just staring at the screen, right? And maybe it's a good time to, that's maybe your body trying to tell you that it's time to take a break and come back to this later. And I don't think your brain ever stops thinking about your dissertation until you're done. So even when you're out enjoying activities, I'm sure your subconscious is writing your thesis for you.
Exactly.
In the background, it's making those connections and it's making those pieces come together so that when you do come back to write, you're ready to go. And you've made some progress.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming in, Sarv. It has been wonderful chatting with you. Thank you so much for sharing all of your work, and good luck with the rest of your PhD as you start to wrap up and work on your papers. And hopefully we will get a chance to chat with you maybe as you start your postdoc work in the future. We'll see. Hopefully we can have you back for another episode.
Definitely, yeah. This has been a treat.
Oh, it's been a treat to have you here as well. So that's it, everyone. another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget that you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM. Grad Chat.
Grad Chat. Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Today on Wings, Sarah Schulman speaks about her nonfiction book titled Conflict Is Not Abuse.
So this book begins with something that so many things in our time begin with, a quote from James Baldwin. Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Sarah Schulman has won awards and fellowships. She's had a dozen novels published and several plays and screenplays produced. She's a distinguished professor, and some of her nonfiction books are published by major university presses. But the book she speaks about in this program was published by a small press in Vancouver, Canada, Arsenal Pulp Press.
Nobody would publish this book in the States. And we've sold, I think, almost 10,000 copies in a year. It's in its fifth edition.
The book is titled Conflict Is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair. In November 2017, Schulman read from the book and talked with the audience in Vancouver for about an hour. Here are excerpts from that event.
No one can negotiate without being heard. Shunning, therefore, is designed to maintain a unilateral position of unmovable superiority by asserting one's status as abused and the implied consequential right to punish without terms. You have someone like Donald Trump who every single day tells us how abused he is, what a victim he is, and how it's a witch hunt, and it's so sad. Usually someone's telling the truth about him and his supremacy, and that's what he's referring to as an attack or abuse. At the same time, he's taking problems that are being experienced by the white working class in America who've had their jobs globalized by the white 1%, and he manipulates their anxieties and projects it onto immigrants, Muslims, and in last week, Haitians. As I began this book during the summer of 2014, we watched white police officers in Ferguson, Missouri and Staten Island, New York, murder two unarmed black men, Michael Brown and Eric Garner. We watched a rich and powerful professional football player, Ray Rice, beat his wife, Janae, unconscious in an elevator. We watched the Israeli government mass murder over 2,000 Palestinian civilians in Gaza. It quickly became apparent that the methods we've developed collectively to date to understand these kinds of actions in order to avoid them are not adequate. Now, as a novelist, in order to create characters that have integrity, I apply the principle that people do things for reasons. Even if they are not aware of those reasons, or even if they cannot accept that their actions are motivated instead of neutral and objective. Using this principle to examine those events, I have to ask myself what the white police officers, the wealthy football player, and the militarized nation state think is happening that produces and justifies their brutal actions. As video and witness accounts attest, neither Michael Brown nor Eric Garner did anything that justified the way they were treated by the police. Eric Garner sold loose cigarettes and Michael Brown walked down the street. Both men tried to offer the police alternatives to cruelty. Eric Garner informed the police of the consequences of their actions on him when he told them 11 times while in an illegal chokehold, "I can't breathe." Michael Brown raised his hands in a sign of surrender and said, "Don't shoot." But something occurred within the minds, impulses, and group identities of the white police officers, and there they saw threat gross enough to justify murder. We know from security camera footage taken in a casino lobby and elevator that Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice and his wife were having a quarrel. As much as we don't like quarrels with our partners and wish they wouldn't happen, disagreement with one's lover is a normal part of human experience. It's impossible to live without it ever taking place. Yet Ray Rice experienced normal, regular conflict that exists in every relationship, family, and household in the world as so overwhelmingly unbearable and threatening that he hit his wife, knocking her unconscious, and dragged her limp body by the ankles out of the elevator, leaving her lying inert in a hallway. He looked at normal, everyday expression of difference, and he saw threat and responded with extreme cruelty. The Israeli government has kept the Palestinian Gaza Strip under siege since 2005. This has made daily life unbearable for its inhabitants. In the late spring of 2014, the government of Benjamin Netanyahu escalated pressure on the already suffering Palestinians, and some factions within Gaza responded with rockets that were of such poor quality they had only symbolic impact. The Israeli government re-reacted in turn to this response with over 50 days of aerial bombing and ground invasion, causing mass death and massive destruction of literal, cultural, and psychological infrastructure. The Gazans were resisting unbearable and unjustifiable treatment. The Israelis experienced this resistance as attack. From the most intimate relationship between two people to the power of the police to the crushing reality of occupation, these actors displayed distorted thinking in which justifiable behavior was understood as aggression. In this way, they overreacted at a level that produced tragedy, pain, and division. It is this moment of overreaction that I wish to examine. My thesis is that at many levels of human interaction, there is the opportunity to conflate discomfort with threat, to mistake internal anxiety for exterior danger, and in turn to escalate rather than resolve. I will show how this dynamic, whether between two individuals, between groups of people, between governments and civilians, or between nations, is a fundamental opportunity for either tragedy or peace. Conscious awareness of these political and emotional mechanisms gives us all a chance to face ourselves, to achieve recognition and understanding in order to avoid escalation towards unnecessary pain. Of course, it is not only the police, wealthy football players, or colonial occupiers who can feel abused in the absence of actual threat. It is not only the dominant who feel endangered when faced with normal conflict or when their own unjust actions are responded to with resistance. In fact, these distorted reactions occur in both the powerful and the weak, the supremacist and the traumatized, in society and in intimacy. In arenas in which real abuse could conceivably take place, there are those who feel persecuted and threatened even though they are not in danger, and they often lack help from those around them to differentiate between the possible and the actual. Bullies often conceptualize themselves as being under attack when they are the ones originating the pain. Everywhere we look, there is confusion between conflict and abuse. If a person cannot solve a conflict with a friend, how can they possibly contribute to larger efforts for peace? If we refuse to speak to a friend because we project our anxieties onto an email they wrote, how are we going to welcome refugees, immigrants, and the homeless into our communities? The values required for social repair are the same values required for personal repair. And so this discussion must begin in the most micro experience.
On Wings, you're listening to excerpts from a talk by Sarah Schulman, author of the book Conflict Is Not Abuse.
On a freezing, snowy day in 2014, I was invited to a workshop run by social worker Catherine Hodes. A native New Yorker in her 50s, Hodes is an experienced professional with over 20 years of development and leadership in what was once known as the battered women's movement, but is now called intimate relationship abuse advocacy. Intimate abuse is a real crisis for New York. In 2014, the police received 284,000 intimate abuse calls in a year, which is about 800 a day, and made 46,000 intimate abuse arrests. Now, Hodes had boldly started to notice that clients were increasingly confused about what the word abuse actually means, that it was overused. The paradox is, of course, that many women are unable to recognize that they are being abused. And many women cannot get acknowledgement of this reality from others. Yet, at the very same time, Hodes also found that some women were applying the term abuse to situations that were really something else. Increasingly, she noticed that women who did not know how to resolve a problem sometimes described that feeling with the word abuse. So this session had been convened to address that trend directly with service providers. While identifying abuse is essential to saving lives and providing services, differentiating conflict from abuse is also essential to meeting clients' real need to learn how to face and deal with obstacles and to develop truthful assessments of themselves and others. And she asks people like, are you in danger or are you angry, upset, and frustrated? If you say I'm angry, upset, and frustrated, you're not going to be like, oh, well, go home. We're going to deal with the fact that you're angry, upset, and frustrated. But we just want to know, like, is that what's happening or are you actually in danger? So that there's validation. Another thing she suggests is looking at the order of events. And this is something that I've tried to use for my, she says when a client comes in, she asks them for the order of events. And almost immediately she can tell whether it's abuse or conflict. So I started using order of events in my own problems. So I'll be like, well, first she did this to me, and then she did that, and then I, you know, whatever. And then she, so I guess that's the part about me, I like smush it, you know what I mean? Like, and like if you have, if your friends help you go through the order of events and they don't let you smush it, you can find out where you have escalated, where you've contributed to creating the conflict. Well, obviously, significant abuse takes place where one person is being controlled by another or by a group in a manner that the recipient has not contributed to and cannot change, but the word abuse has become overused. People may feel angry, frustrated, upset, but this does not mean they are being abused. They could instead be in conflict. Therefore, the fact that one person is truly suffering does not inherently mean that the other party is to blame. People may not know how to make things better, how to look at their own participation, how to deal with feeling badly about themselves. They may not know how to understand their own actions and are afraid of the implications of their actions on the meaning of their lives. And this may be devastating, tormenting, and painful, but this is not being abused. It does not get resolved by organizing the punishment of another person. People may be part of negative friendships, families, or communities who attack outsiders instead of being self-critical. They may be receiving encouragement to blame and scapegoat others. They may live within groups, relationships, or families that do not tolerate the admission of mistakes and that reinforce supremacy ideologies about each other in order to maintain illusions of righteousness. This pressure, resulting in the action of collectively deflecting blame, does not mean that the person being blamed is abusive. In fact, it says nothing at all about that person, except that they are being blamed. Okay. So what's interesting is as we were doing this workshop with Hodes, she started to explain to us that increasingly perpetrators have seized the apparatus, the state apparatus that was designed to protect victims. She said that perpetrators increasingly are the first ones to call the police, to threaten legal action, to send lawyer letters, or threaten or seek restraining orders as part and parcel of their agenda of blame and unilateral control. And the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs 2014 report on LGBTQI intimate partner abuse noted that the police misarrested the survivor as the perpetrator of violence in over half of all queer domestic abuse arrests, misidentifying the perpetrator in same-sex relationships as the one who is butch, of color, not a mother, not a citizen, from another culture, or HIV positive. One of Hodes' many valuable suggestions is to lower the bar for what must happen in a person's life for their suffering to be acknowledged. Quote, "The current paradigm is encouraging all of us to think we are in abusive relationships," Hodes explained, "and if you are not in an abusive relationship, you don't deserve help. Being abused is what makes you eligible, but everyone deserves help when they reach out for it." This is a strikingly humane idea, that the collapse of conflict and abuse is partly the result of a punitive standard in which people are made desperate, yet ineligible for compassion. So, like in 1958, when I was born in New York City, if a woman was raped, she could only get a conviction if she had what? Does anybody know?
A witness.
A witness. She had to have a witness. So at that period, the state was literally the enemy of women. And in the 1960s, when the feminist movement against male violence began, it was a movement that did not look for any kind of solution in the state. It had no expectations that the state would help women. In fact, there were very few women even in the state in terms of women lawyers and judges and this sort of thing. But also because that movement emerged at a time when globally there were a lot of revolutionary movements that were radically imagining transformations of our relationships to each other. There were post-colonial movements, gay liberation, women's liberation, black power, you know, radical movements with radical analyses. So when you look back at the 1960s feminist movement against male violence, you see that they attribute male violence against women and children to three things: patriarchy, poverty, and racism. So they saw it as structural. And their focus was not on punishing men. Their focus was on empowering women. So they did a lot of things that today we would call restorative justice, even though those words did not exist at that time. So, for example, abortion was illegal. They organized, you know, illegal abortion networks. They taught women self-defense classes. There were rape crisis hotlines. If you were raped, you could call a number, and a woman who had been raped would be on the other end. So these were solutions that were community-based. They did not involve the state. But the demand for these services was enormous, far more than a basic grassroots political movement could create. In the 1970s, the U.S. government started a program called CETA, where they would pay the salaries of people who ran these grassroots organizations. But in 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected, and that's like D-Day for all the problems that are going on in the states right now, right? So one of the first things he did, I think it was in the first 3 weeks of office, was he eliminated CETA, and a lot of these programs fell apart. What you start to see in the 80s is that the government starts to take on this role. So the government is saying, we are now going to be the people who are going to be in charge of violence. So we have programs that are all dependent on government funding. In order to work in the programs, you have to have government credentials. But even more dramatically, there's a huge crisis of meaning because the U.S. government is one of the greatest sources of violence in the world. So they cannot be the people in charge of ending violence. Also, the enforcers of their policies are the police. A police officer is the occupation with the highest rate of domestic violence of any occupation in the United States, including football player. So police officers do not know how to solve problems, and they're the last people you should be calling if you have a problem. So what we're seeing is this movement from this idea that communities should be helping each other address these conflicts to it being embedded in the state. And there was a lot of propaganda for this in popular culture. So the 80s is when you start to see things like Law and Order Special Victims Unit, right? So every week on TV, you're seeing an episode where there's a completely pure and innocent victim, and there's a totally evil predator. And the answer is the police. But the American police do not know how to solve conflict. We see stories in the U.S. press. A guy is having a fight with his son. He calls the police. The police come. They kill the son. Calling the police when we're actually in conflict instead of abuse. We do it to show that we are the pure victim and that we have no participation in escalating the conflict and we need the police. It's a performance of innocence. Because the way things are now is that the only way you get compassion from other people is if you're purely and completely innocent. But if we could allow a concept of our group relationships that allows people to be complex and to make mistakes and to show that they're contributing to escalating conflict without them being punished or shunned or humiliated, we would take back a lot of this power that we have as a community to try to address our own conflicts. Because what's going on right now, I think, is that the sign that we're being heard in our suffering is when the other person gets punished. These two things are completely linked, and they need to be separated. There needs to be a way that we can be heard, that we are authentically suffering and in pain, without the only proof of being heard being that somebody else is being hurt. You know, right now we define loyalty by meaning that we will join with the other people in our group to hurt the people who they say are their enemies or have been bad to them. That's how we define loyalty. And I'm amazed at how many times people ask me to hurt other people. They're like, why did you invite her? You shouldn't work with him. Don't go to that party, whatever it is. They're always telling you to isolate people, pretend they don't exist, pretend that people that we're sharing the earth with are not there. You know, and that's the definition of loyalty. And I'm saying that real loyalty and real love and real friendship is when you say, how can I help you negotiate? How can I be there for you so that you can take responsibility for your part in creating this conflict? You know, there's somebody who your clique had a falling out with like 5 years ago, and every time you see that person, you have a bad vibe with them, and then one day you realize you cannot remember what the incident was that you're still punishing this person for. At that point, just like say hi. You know, you see them, just say hi, how are you? You don't have to get into a big thing, but just like, who do we think that we make ourselves by hurting other people forever? Without terms, shunning without terms. There have to be terms. Like if you stole my money to buy drugs, I have the right to say, hey man, you can't come into my house until you have 3 years sober. I think that that's fair, but those are terms. But for me to say, no matter who you become and no matter what you do in your life, I'm never gonna treat you with respect again, that's absurd. It's about our self-image, that we have this idea that we are the good one, that we are the righteous one because the other is the specter, they hold all the evil. There's a lot of different reasons that we're suffering, and sometimes it is a direct consequence of that person's actions, but sometimes it comes from our histories. I mean, I was born in 1958, which is 13 years after the end of the Holocaust, right? And I was raised with a concept of profound oppression, of Jewish oppression. And you know, in 1944, 1945, Jews may have been the most oppressed people in the world. But in 1948, 3 little years later, when the Israeli state was founded, Zionists were able to seize control of the state apparatus and make another people, Palestinians, subordinate. So you have this going from extreme oppression, which has trauma that travels through generations. It doesn't suddenly end. And because of that history and that experience, people could not accept that they were now in an oppressor position. They could not emotionally accept who they really were in relationship to Palestinians and maintain this constant victim rhetoric. And you see the same thing with gay people. I mean, gay people who were profoundly oppressed, who lost their families, whose communities were decimated by AIDS because governments didn't care, who didn't have basic rights. And now we're in the homo nationalist period, where white gay people are invited into the state apparatus, joining the imperialist military. You know, this kind of white reconciliation between white gay people and white straight people to reinforce whiteness. And yet there's still a kind of a rhetoric that comes from the past that doesn't acknowledge how that whiteness that they were maybe once excluded from on a certain level is now fully informed. So to be up to date on who you really are, you could have, and just it's the same thing's true for individuals. As children, we could have had terrible experiences of being completely defenseless and not being able to protect ourselves and being manipulated and violated. But as adults, we may have more autonomy than we actually understand that we have, because we're still living with the consequences of the past, having unresolved pain from the past and trying to make the present accountable for something that the present has not created, which I guess is the famous trigger. The problem of how to turn these things around is really hard. I know that, like, this book, I know that I've gotten a lot of crazy accusations against me online. Like, there was somebody who wrote, Sarah Schulman is a known abuser. She punched her girlfriend in the face and broke her nose. This never happened, by the way. You know, and then somebody else writes, what do you mean? How do you know that? And they go, it's well known. And then, like, there it is, you know, or then it's on Tumblr and it's shared 1,000 times, and then everyone's like, she's an abuser. You know, I mean, now there's two questions that come from this. Is one, how do you stop it? And the only way to stop it is third-party intervention. When people who are not you call up that person and say, you know, why are you doing this? If you have evidence, let me see it. If you don't, you know, you're doing, this is really painful. And I don't want to be in a community where this is what's happening. We have to intervene. And this concept of third-party intervention comes from a book that I wrote called Ties That Bind, Familial Homophobia and Its Consequences. It was the first analysis of homophobia in the family. And it's when I realized that the queer person is alone in there, in the family, and that our queer communities do not intervene with homophobic families. We privilege the family. And that we have to let that go. We have to have third-party intervention where we call the family and say, listen, you know, this is a beloved person in this community, and the way you're treating them is not right. And we don't, you know, we don't want you to treat them that way. So you have to step up and defend people. Because if you're defending yourself, it's not going to change. There's a thing going around saying that my book is telling people to call the police. Okay, obviously it's not doing that. It's doing the opposite, right? They never read it. They never read it. And it's been shared like hundreds of times. And when I see it, I'll say, like, listen, do you want me to send you a copy of the book? Why don't you come to my, you know, discussion, or we can have a public discussion? They never come. You cannot have punishment without process, because this is how we all got stigmatized in the first place. Even if the process is painful, even if the process takes place in a group of friends, in a family, it doesn't have to be a state process. But just because someone is accused doesn't mean that they should be punished. I mean, it's really fun to watch these assholes get taken down. But, you know, who's firing them? The people who are firing them are just as bad as they are. And if a person really did do these things, what is appropriate punishment? You did X, you know, it could be rape. Or it could be like asking someone to have sex with you. Right now, those are all the same. And if you do them, you lose your corporate job, and that's the punishment, and then it's over. But I'm not so sure that that's really the appropriate response either. You know, this kind of thing can trickle down, and it can get really messy, because pretty soon we're going to be saying, she broke her girlfriend's nose, you shouldn't let her read at your bookstore, and there's not going to be any kind of discussion.
Excerpts from a talk by Sarah Schulman, whose book Conflict is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair, won the 2017 Judy Grant Award for Lesbian Nonfiction. It's published in Vancouver, Canada, by Arsenal Pulp Press. Schulman was recorded by Robin Erickson. The talk was edited by Frieda Worden. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose salons can be found at the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Visit the Screening Room, Kingston's only independent movie theater located downtown at 120 Princess Street. They specialize in playing art house, international classic, and cult cinema, along with Hollywood's best new releases. People also always say they have the best popcorn in town. Visit Screening Room at screeningroom.com for upcoming show dates and ticket information.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the war within the Rogers family. And the person telling me that story is Michael Healy, who's a friend of mine. Wait for that. If the We Charity scandal had happened in another country, they'd have made a movie about it. Not a documentary, but a movie. Lights, camera, action. Maybe cast both of the Ryans as the brothers. Owen Wilson as Justin Trudeau. And that's not just if it had happened in the States. Like a story like that, it's got celebrities, crime, politics, a child star's fall from grace, cameos from Oprah and the Dalai Lama, international, epic scope, sweeping story. If that had happened in the UK, they'd have made a movie about it. Australia, France, Germany, anywhere else. I'm not just talking